civilized hour of 7, but the light was on in Moore's office. I could see it through the pebbled glass. I gave a perfunctory knock and opened the door. Moore's looked up, startled to see anyone at that unusual hour, and I would have given a great deal not to have been the one to see him in that condition, with his face naked and unguarded. His white hair, usually so neatly combed, was sticking up in tufts and tangles. His hands were in it, yanking and pulling when I walked in. His eyes were raw, the skin beneath them puffy and swollen. His palsy was the worst I had ever seen it. He looked like a man who had just come inside after a long walk on a terribly cold night. "Hal, I'm sorry. I'll come back," I began. "No," he said. "Please, Paul, come in. Shut the door and come in. I need someone now if I haven't needed anyone in my whole life. Shut the door and come in." I did as he asked, forgetting my own pain for the first time since I'd awakened that morning. "It's a brain tumor," Moore's said. "They got X-ray pictures of it. They seemed real pleased with their pictures, actually. One of them said they may be the best ones anyone's ever gotten, at least so far, said they're going to publish them in some biggity medical journal up in New England. It's as big as a lemon, they said, and way down deep inside where they can't operate. They say she'll be dead by Christmas. I haven't told her. Can't think how. I can't think how for the life of me." Then he began to cry. Big, gasping sobs that filled me with both pity and a kind of terror. When a man who keeps himself as tightly guarded as Hal Moore's finally does lose control, it's frightening to watch. I stood there for a moment, then went to him and put my arm around his shoulders. He groped out for me with both of his own arms like a drowning man and began to sob against my stomach, all restraint washed away. Later, after he got himself under control, he apologized. He did it without meeting my eyes, as a man does when he feels he has embarrassed himself dreadfully, maybe so deeply that he can never quite live it down. A man can end up hating the fellow who has seen him in such a state. I thought Warden Moore's was better than that, but it never crossed my mind to do the business I had originally come for, and when I left Moore's office, I walked over to E Block instead of back to my car. The aspirin was working by then, and the pain in my midsection was down to a low throb. I would get through the day somehow, I reckoned, get Wharton settled in, check back with Hal Moore's that afternoon, and get my sick leave for tomorrow. The worst was pretty much over, I thought, with no slightest idea that the worst of that day's mischief hadn't even begun. Chapter 11.
"We thought he's still doped from the tests," Dean said late that afternoon. His voice was low, rasping, almost a bark, and there were blackish-purple bruises rising on his neck. I could see it was hurting him to talk, and thought of telling him to let it go. But sometimes it hurts more to be quiet. I judged that this was one of those times, and kept my own mouth shut. "We all thought he's doped, didn't we?"
Harry Terwilliger nodded. Even Percy, sitting off by himself in his own sullen little party of one, nodded. Brutal glanced at me, and for a moment I met his eyes. We were thinking pretty much that same thing, that this was the way it happened. You were cruising along, everything going according to Hoyle, you made one mistake, and bang, the sky fell down on you. They had thought he was doped. It was a reasonable assumption to make, but no one had asked if he was doped. I thought I saw something else in Brutal's eyes as well. Harry and Dean would learn from their mistake, especially Dean, who could easily have gone home dead. Percy wouldn't. Percy maybe couldn't. All Percy could do was sit in the corner and sulk because he was in the shit again. There were 7 of them that went up to Indianola to pick up Wild Bill Wharton. Harry, Dean, Percy, 2 other guards in the back, I've forgotten their names, although I'm sure I knew them once, plus 2 up front. They took what we used to call the stagecoach, a Ford panel truck which had been steel-reinforced and equipped with supposedly bulletproof glass. It looked like a cross between a milk wagon and an armored car. Harry Terwilliger was technically in charge of the expedition. He handed his paperwork over to the county sheriff, not Homer Kribus, but some other elected yokel like him, I imagine, who in turn handed over Mr. William Wharton, hellraiser extraordinaire, as Delacroix might have put it. A Cold Mountain prison uniform had been sent ahead, but the sheriff and his men hadn't bothered to put Wharton in it. They left that to our boys. Wharton was dressed in a cotton hospital johnny and cheap felt slippers when they first met him on the second floor of the general hospital, a scrawny man with a narrow, pimply face and a lot of long, tangly blonde hair. His ass, also narrow and also covered with pimples, stuck out the back of the johnny. That was the part of him Harry and the others saw first, because Wharton was standing at the window and looking out at the parking lot when they came in. He didn't turn, but just stood there, holding the curtains back with one hand, silent as a doll, while Harry bitched at the county sheriff about being too lazy to get Wharton into his prison blues, and the county sheriff lectured, as every county official I've ever met seems bound to do, about what was his job and what was not. When Harry got tired of that part, I doubt it took him long, he told Wharton to turn around. Wharton did. He looked, Dean told us, in his raspy bark of a half-choked voice, like any one of a thousand backcountry stampeders who had wound their way through Cold Mountain during our years there. Boil that look down, and what you got was a dullard with a mean streak. Sometimes you also discovered a yellow streak in him once their backs were to the wall, but more often there was nothing there but fight and mean, and then more fight and more mean. There are people who see nobility in folks like Billy Wharton, but I am not one of them. A rat will fight, too, if it is cornered. This man's face seemed to have no more personality than his acne-studded backside, Dean told us. His jaw was slack, his eyes distant, his shoulders slumped, his hands dangling. He looked shot up with morphine, all right, every bit as cuckoo as any dope fiend any of them had ever seen. At this, Percy gave another of his sullen nods. "Put this on," Harry said, indicating the uniform on the foot of the bed. It had been taken out of the brown paper it had been wrapped in, but otherwise not touched. It was still folded, just as it had been in the prison laundry, with a pair of white cotton boxer shorts poking out of one shirt sleeve and a pair of white socks poking out of the other. Wharton seemed willing enough to comply, but wasn't able to get very far without help. He managed the boxers, but when it came to the pants, he kept trying to put both legs into the same hole. Finally, Dean helped him, getting his feet to go where they belonged, and then yanking the trousers up, doing the fly, and snapping the waistband. Wharton only stood there, not even trying to help, once he saw that Dean was doing it for him. He stared vacantly across the room, hands lax, and it didn't occur to any of them that he was shamming. Not in hopes of escape, at least I don't believe that was it, but only in hopes of making the maximum amount of trouble when the right time came. The papers were signed. William Wharton, who had become county property when he was arrested, now became the state's property. He was taken down the back stairs and through the kitchen, surrounded by blue suits. He walked with his head down and his long-fingered hands dangling. The first time his cap fell off, Dean put it back on him. The second time, he just tucked it into his own back pocket. He had another chance to make trouble in the back of the stagecoach when they were shackling him and didn't. If he thought, even now I'm not sure if he did, or if he did how much, he must have thought that the space was too small and the numbers too great to cause a satisfactory hoorah. So on went the chains, one set running between his ankles and another set, too long, it turned out, between his wrists. The drive to Cold Mountain took an hour. During that whole time, Wharton sat on the left-hand bench up by the cab, head lowered, cuffed hands dangling between his knees. Every now and then he hummed a little, Harry said, and Percy roused himself enough from his funk to say that the lagoon dripped spittle from his lax lower lip, a drop at a time, until it had made a puddle between his feet, like a dog dripping off the end of its tongue on a hot summer day. They drove in through the south gate when they got to the pen, right past my car, I guess. The guard on the south pass ran back the big door between the lot and the exercise yard, and the stagecoach drove through. It was a slack time in the yard, not many men out, and most of them hoeing in the garden. Pumpkin time, it would have been. They drove straight across to E Block and stopped. The driver opened the door and told them he was going to take the stagecoach over to the motor pool to have the oil changed. It had been good working with them. The extra guards went with the vehicle. two of them sitting in the back, the doors now swinging open. That left Dean, Harry, and Percy with one shackled prisoner. It should have been enough, would have been enough, if they hadn't been lulled by the stick-thin country boy standing head down there in the dirt with chains on his wrists and ankles. They marched him the 12 or so paces to the door that opened into E Block, falling into the same formation we used when escorting prisoners down the Green Mile. Harry was on his left, Dean was on his right, and Percy was behind, with his baton in his hand. No one told me that, but I know damned well he had it out. Percy loved that hickory stick. As for me, I was sitting in what would be Wharton's home until it came time for him to check into the hot place. First cell on the right as you headed down the corridor toward the restraint room. I had my clipboard in my hands and was thinking of nothing but making my set little speech and getting the hell out. The pain in my groin was building up again, and all I wanted was to go into my office and wait for it to pass. Dean stepped forward to unlock the door. He selected the right key from the bunch on his belt and slid it into the lock. Wharton came alive just as Dean turned the key and pulled the handle. He voiced a screaming, gibbering cry, a kind of rebel yell that froze Harry to temporary immobility and pretty much finished Percy Wetmore for the entire encounter. I heard that scream through the partly open door and didn't associate it with anything human at first. I thought a dog had gotten into the yard somehow and had been hurt, and perhaps some mean-tempered con had hit it with a hoe. Wharton lifted his arms, dropped the chain which hung between his wrists over Dean's head, and commenced to choke him with it. Dean gave a strangled cry and lurched forward into the cool electric light of our little world. Wharton was happy to go with him, even gave him a shove, all the time yelling and gibbering, even laughing. He had his arms cocked at the elbows, with his fists up by Dean's ears, yanking the chain as tight as he could, whipsawing it back and forth. Harry landed on Wharton's back, wrapping one hand in our new boy's greasy blonde hair and slamming his other fist into the side of Wharton's face as hard as he could. He had both a baton of his own and a sidearm pistol, but in his excitement drew neither. We'd had trouble with prisoners before, you bet, but never one who'd taken us by surprise the way that Wharton did. The man's slyness was beyond our experience. I had never seen its like before and have never seen it again. And he was strong. All that slack looseness was gone. Harry said later that it was like jumping onto a coiled nest of steel springs that had somehow come to life. Wharton, now inside and near the duty desk, whirled to his left and flung Harry off. Harry hit the desk and went sprawling.
"Hewee, boys!" Wharton laughed. "Ain't this a party now? Is it or what?"
Still screaming and laughing, Wharton went back to choking Dean with his chain. Why not? Wharton knew what we all knew. They could only fry him once.
"Hit him, Percy! Hit him!" Harry screamed, struggling to his feet, but Percy only stood there, hickory baton in hand, eyes as wide as soup plates.
Here was the chance he'd been looking for, you would have said, his golden opportunity to put that tallywhacker of his to good use, and he was too scared and confused to do it. This wasn't some terrified little Frenchman or a black giant who hardly seemed to be in his own body. This was a whirling devil. I came out of Wharton's cell, dropping my clipboard and pulling my .38. I had forgotten the infection that was heating up my middle for the second time that day. I didn't doubt the story the others told of Wharton's blank face and dull eyes when they told it, but that wasn't the Wharton I saw. What I saw was the face of an animal. Not an intelligent animal, but one filled with cunning and meanness and joy. Yes, he was doing what he had been made to do. The place and the circumstances didn't matter. The other thing I saw was Dean Stanton's red, swelling face. He was dying in front of my eyes. Wharton saw the gun and turned Dean toward it, so that I'd almost certainly have to hit one to hit the other. From over Dean's shoulder, one blazing blue eye dared me to shoot.
Part 3. Coffee's Hands.
Chapter 1. Looking back through what I've written, I see that I called Georgia Pines, where I now live, a nursing home. The folks who run the place wouldn't be very happy with that. According to the brochures they keep in the lobby and send out to prospective clients, it's a state-of-the-art retirement complex for the elderly. It even has a resource center. The brochure says so. The folks who have to live here, the brochure doesn't call us inmates, but sometimes I do, just call it the TV room. Folks think I'm standoffy because I don't go down there to the TV room much in the day, but it's the programs I can't stand, not the folks. Oprah, Ricky Lake, Carney, Wilson, Rolanda. The world is falling down around our ears, and all these people care about is talking about fucking to women in short skirts and men with their shirts hanging open. Well, hell, judge not lest ye be judged, the Bible says, so I'll get down off my soapbox. It's just that if I wanted to spend time with trailer trash, I'd move 2 miles down to the Happy Wheels Motor Court, where the police cars always seem to be headed on Friday and Saturday nights, with their sirens screaming and their blue lights flashing. My special friend, Elaine Connolly, feels the same way. Elaine is 80, tall and slim, still erect and clear-eyed, very intelligent and refined. She walks very slowly because there's something wrong with her hips, and I know that the arthritis in her hands gives her terrible misery. But she has a beautiful long neck, a swan neck almost, and long, pretty hair that falls to her shoulders when she lets it down. Best of all, she doesn't think I'm peculiar or standoffy. We spend a lot of time together, Elaine and I. If I hadn't reached such a grotesque age, I suppose I might speak of her as my lady friend. Still, having a special friend, just that, is not so bad, and in some ways it's even better. A lot of the problems and heartaches that go with being boyfriend and girlfriend have simply burned out of us. And although I know that no one under the age of, say, 50 would believe this, sometimes the embers are better than the campfire. It's strange, but it's true. So I don't watch TV during the day. Sometimes I walk, sometimes I read. Mostly what I've been doing for the last month or so is writing this memoir among the plants in the solarium. I think there's more oxygen in that room, and it helps the old memory. It beats the hell out of Geraldo Rivera, I can tell you that. But when I can't sleep, I sometimes creep downstairs and put on the television. There's no home box office or anything at Georgia Pines. I guess that's a resource just a wee bit too expensive for our resource center. But we have the basic cable services, and that means we have the American Movie Channel. That's the one, just in case you don't have the basic cable services yourself, where most of the films are in black and white and none of the women take off their clothes. For an old fart like me, that's sort of soothing. There have been a good many nights when I've slipped right off to sleep on the ugly green sofa in front of the TV while Francis the Talking Mule once more pulls Donald O'Connor's skillet out of the fire, or John Wayne cleans up Dodge, or Jimmy Cagney calls someone a dirty rat and then pulls a gun. Some of them are movies I saw with my wife, Janice, not just my lady friend, but my best friend. And they calm me. The clothes they wear, the way they walk and talk, even the music on the soundtrack, all those things calm me. They remind me, I suppose, of when I was a man still walking on the skin of the world, instead of a moth-eaten relic moldering away in an old folks' home where many of the residents wear diapers and rubber pants. There was nothing soothing about what I saw this morning, though. Nothing at all. Elaine sometimes joins me for AMC's so-called early bird matinee, which starts at 4 a.m. She doesn't say much about it, but I know her arthritis hurts her something terrible, and that the drugs they give her don't help much anymore. When she came in this morning, gliding like a ghost in her white terry-cloth robe, she found me sitting on the lumpy sofa, bent over the scrawny sticks that used to be legs, and clutching my knees to try and still the shakes that were running through me like a high wind. I felt cold all over, except for my groin, which seemed to burn with the ghost of the urinary infection which had so troubled my life in the fall of 1932. The fall of John Coffey, Percy Wetmore, and Mr. Jingles, the trained mouse. The fall of William Wharton, it had been, too.
"Paul!"
Elaine cried, and hurried over to me, hurried as fast as the rusty nails and ground glass in her hips would allow, anyway.
"Paul, what's wrong?"
"I'll be all right," I said. But the words didn't sound very convincing. They came out all uneven, through teeth that wanted to chatter. "Just give me a minute or two. I'll be right as rain." She sat next to me and put her arm around my shoulders.
"I'm sure," she said. "But what happened? For heaven's sake, Paul, you look like you saw a ghost."
"I did," I thought, and didn't realize until her eyes widened that I'd said it out loud.
"Not really,"
I said, and patted her hand, gently, so gently. "But for a minute, Elaine. God."
"Was it from the time when you were a guard at the prison?" she asked. "The time that you've been writing about in the solarium?"
I nodded. "I worked on our version of Death Row."
"I know."
"Only we called it the Green Mile, because of the linoleum on the floor. In the fall of 32, we got this wild man named William Wharton. Liked to think of himself as Billy the Kid, even had it tattooed on his arm. Just a kid, but dangerous. I can still remember what Curtis Anderson, he was the assistant warden back in those days, wrote about him. Crazy, wild, and proud of it. Wharton is 19 years old, and he just doesn't care," he'd underline that part. The hand which had gone around my shoulders was now rubbing my back. I was beginning to calm. In that moment, I loved Elaine Connolly, and could have kissed her all over her face as I told her so. Maybe I should have. It's terrible to be alone and frightened at any age, but I think it's worst when you're old. But I had this other thing on my mind, this load of old and still unfinished business. "Anyway," I said, "you're right. I've been scribbling about how Wharton came on the block and almost killed Dean Stanton, one of the guys I worked with back then, when he did."
"How could he do that?" Elaine asked.
"Meanness and carelessness," I said grimly. "Wharton supplied the meanness, and the guards who brought him in supplied the carelessness. The real mistake was Wharton's wrist chain. It was a little too long. When Dean unlocked the door to E Block, Wharton was behind him. There were guards on either side of him, but Anderson was right. Wild Billy just didn't care about such things. He dropped that wrist chain down over Dean's head and started choking him with it." Elaine shuddered. "Anyway, I got thinking about all that and couldn't sleep. So I came down here. I turned on AMC, thinking you might come down and we'd have us a little date." She laughed and kissed my forehead just above the eyebrow. It used to make me prickle all over when Janice did that, and it still made me prickle all over when Elaine did it early this morning. I guess some things don't ever change. And what came on was this old black-and-white gangster movie from the 40s. Kiss of Death, it's called. I could feel myself wanting to start shaking again and tried to suppress it. "Richard Widmark's in it," I said. "It was his first big part, I think. I never went to see it with Jan. We gave the cops and robbers a miss, usually. But I remember reading somewhere that Widmark gave one hell of a performance as the punk. He sure did." He's pale, doesn't seem to walk so much as go gliding around. He's always calling people squirt, talking about squealers, how much he hates the squealers. I was starting to shiver again in spite of my best efforts. I just couldn't help it. Blonde hair, I whispered. Lank, blonde hair. I watched until the part where he pushed this old woman in a wheelchair down a flight of stairs, then I turned it off. He reminded you of Wharton? He was Wharton, I said. To the life. Paul, she began and stopped. She looked at the blank screen of the TV. The cable box on top of it was still on, the red numeral still showing 10, the number of the AMC channel. Then back at me. What? I asked. What, Elaine? Thinking she's going to tell me I ought to quit writing about it, that I ought to tear up the pages I've written so far and just quit on it. What she said was,
don't let this stop you.
I gawped at her.
Close your mouth, Paul. You'll catch a fly.
Sorry. It's just that... Well,
you thought I was going to tell you just the opposite, didn't you?
Yes. She took my hands in hers, gently, so gently, her long and beautiful fingers, her bunched and ugly knuckles, and leaned forward, fixing my blue eyes with her hazel ones, the left slightly dimmed by the mist of a coalescing cataract.
I may be too old and brittle to live, she said, but I'm not too old to think. What's a few sleepless nights at our age? What's seeing a ghost on the TV, for that matter? Are you going to tell me it's the only one you've ever seen?
I thought about Warden Moores, and Harry Terwilliger, and Brutus Howell. I thought about my mother, and about Jan, my wife, who died in Alabama. I knew about ghosts, all right.
No, I said. It wasn't the first ghost I've ever seen.
But, Elaine, it was a shock. Because it was him. She kissed me again, then stood up, wincing as she did so, and pressing the heels of her hands to the tops of her hips, as if she were afraid they might actually explode out through her skin if she wasn't very careful.
I think I've changed my mind about the television, she said. I've got an extra pill that I've been keeping for a rainy day, or night. I think I'll take it and go back to bed. Maybe you should do the same.
Yes, I said, I suppose I should. For one wild moment, I thought of suggesting that we go back to bed together, and then I saw the dull pain in her eyes and thought better of it. Because she might have said yes, and she would only have said that for me. Not so good. We left the TV room, I won't dignify it with that other name, not even to be ironic, side by side, me matching my steps to hers, which were slow and painfully careful. The building was quiet, except for someone moaning in the grip of a bad dream behind some closed door.
"Will you be able to sleep, do you think?" she asked.
"Yes, I think so," I said. But of course I wasn't able to. I lay in my bed until sunup, thinking about Kiss of Death. I'd see Richard Widmark, giggling madly, tying the old lady into her wheelchair, and then pushing her down the stairs. "This is what we do to squealers," he told her, and then his face would merge into the face of William Wharton, as he'd looked on the day when he came to E-Block and the Green Mile, Wharton giggling like Widmark, Wharton screaming, "Ain't this a party now? Is it or what?" I didn't bother with breakfast. Not after that. I just came down here to the solarium and began to write. Ghosts? Sure. I know all about ghosts. Chapter 2.
"Hoo-ee, boys!" Wharton laughed. "Ain't this a party now? Is it or what?"
Still screaming and laughing, Wharton went back to choking Dean with his chain. Why not? Wharton knew what Dean and Harry and my friend Brutus Howell knew. They could only fry a man once.
Hit him!
Harry Terwilliger screamed. He had grappled with Wharton, tried to stop things before they got fairly started, but Wharton had thrown him off, and now Harry was trying to find his feet.
Percy, hit him!
But Percy only stood there, hickory baton in hand, eyes as wide as soup plates. He loved that damned baton of his, and you would have said this was the chance to use it he'd been pining for ever since he came to Cold Mountain Penitentiary, but now that it had come, he was too scared to use the opportunity. This wasn't some terrified little Frenchman like Delacroix, or a black giant who hardly seemed to know he was in his own body like John Coffey. This was a whirling devil. I came out of Wharton's cell, dropping my clipboard and pulling my .38. For the second time that day, I had forgotten the infection that was heating up my middle. I didn't doubt the story the others told of Wharton's blank face and dull eyes when they recounted it later, but that wasn't the Wharton I saw. What I saw was the face of an animal. Not an intelligent animal, but one filled with cunning and meanness and joy. Yes, he was doing what he had been made to do. The place and the circumstances didn't matter. The other thing I saw was Dean Stanton's red, swelling face. He was dying in front of my eyes. Wharton saw the gun in my hand and turned Dean toward it, so that I'd almost certainly have to hit one to hit the other. From over Dean's shoulder, one blazing blue eye dared me to shoot. Wharton's other eye was hidden by Dean's hair. Behind them, I saw Percy, standing irresolute, with his baton half raised. And then, filling the open doorway to the prison yard, a miracle in the flesh, Brutus Howell. They had finished moving the last of the infirmary equipment, and he had come over to see who wanted coffee. He acted without a moment's hesitation. Shoved Percy aside and into the wall with tooth-rattling force, pulled his own baton out of its loop, and brought it crashing down on the back of Wharton's head with all the force in his massive right arm. There was a dull whock sound, an almost hollow sound, as if there were no brain at all under Wharton's skull, and the chain finally loosened around Dean's neck. Wharton went down like a sack of meal, and Dean crawled away, hacking harshly and holding one hand to his throat, his eyes bulging. I knelt by him, and he shook his head violently.
"Okay," he rasped. "Take care of him,"
he motioned at Wharton.
"Lock! Cell!"
I didn't think he'd need a cell, as hard as Brutal had hit him. I thought he'd need a coffin. No such luck, though. Wharton was conked out, but a long way from dead. He lay sprawled on his side, one arm thrown out so that the tips of his fingers touched the linoleum of the Green Mile, his eyes shut, his breathing slow but regular. There was even a peaceful little smile on his face, as if he'd gone to sleep listening to his favorite lullaby. A tiny red rill of blood was seeping out of his hair and staining the collar of his new prison shirt. That was all. "Percy," I said, "help me." Percy didn't move, only stood against the wall, staring with wide, stunned eyes. I don't think he knew exactly where he was.
"Percy, goddammit, grab hold of him!"
He got moving then, and Harry helped him. Together, the three of us hauled the unconscious Mr. Wharton into his cell, while Brutal helped Dean to his feet and held him as gently as any mother, while Dean bent over and hacked air back into his lungs. Our new problem child didn't wake up for almost 3 hours. But when he did, he showed absolutely no ill effects from Brutal's savage hit. He came to the way he moved, fast. At one moment he was lying on his bunk, dead to the world. At the next he was standing at the bars, he was silent as a cat, and staring out at me as I sat at the duty desk writing a report on the incident. When I finally sensed someone looking at me and glanced up, there he was, his grin displaying a set of blackening, dying teeth with several gaps among them already. It gave me a jump to see him there like that. I tried not to show it, but I think he knew.
"Hey, Flunky," he said.
Next time it'll be you, and I won't miss.
Hello, Wharton, I said as evenly as I could. Under the circumstances, I guess I can skip the speech in the welcome wagon, don't you think? His grin faltered just a little. It wasn't the sort of response he had expected, and probably wasn't the one I would have given under other circumstances. But something had happened while Wharton was unconscious. It is, I suppose, one of the major things I have trudged through all these pages to tell you about. Now let's just see if you believe it. Chapter 3. Except for shouting once at Delacroix, Percy kept his mouth shut once the excitement was over. This was probably the result of shock rather than any effort at tact. Percy Wetmore knew as much about tact as I do about the native tribes of darkest Africa, in my opinion. But it was a damned good thing, just the same. If he'd started in whining about how Brutal had pushed him into the wall, or wondering why no one had told him that nasty men like Wild Billy Wharton sometimes turned up on E-Block, I think we would have killed him. Then we could have toured the Green Mile in a whole new way. That's sort of a funny idea when you consider it. I missed my chance to make like James Cagney in White Heat. Anyway, when we were sure that Dean was going to keep breathing and that he wasn't going to pass out on the spot, Harry and Brutal escorted him over to the infirmary. Delacroix, who had been absolutely silent during the scuffle, he had been in prison lots of times, that one, and knew when it was prudent to keep his yap shut and when it was relatively safe to open it again, began bawling loudly down the corridor as Harry and Brutal helped Dean out. Delacroix wanted to know what had happened. You would have thought his constitutional rights had been violated.
"Shut up, you little queer!"
Percy yelled back, so furious that the veins stood out on the sides of his neck. I put a hand on his arm and felt it quivering beneath his shirt. Some of this was residual fright, of course. Every now and then I had to remind myself that part of Percy's problem was that he was only 21, not much older than Wharton, but I think most of it was rage. He hated Delacroix. I don't know just why, but he did. "Go see if Warden Moores is still here," I told Percy. "If he is, give him a complete verbal report on what happened. Tell him he'll have my written report on his desk tomorrow if I can manage it." Percy swelled visibly at this responsibility. For a horrible moment or two, I actually thought he might salute.
"Yes, sir, I will."
"Begin by telling him that the situation in E Block is normal. It's not a story, and the warden won't appreciate you dragging it out to heighten the suspense."
"I won't."
"Okay. Off you go." He started for the door, then turned back. The one thing you could count on with him was contrariness. I desperately wanted him gone. My groin was on fire, and now he didn't seem to want to go.
"Are you all right, Pa?"
he asked.
"Running a fever, maybe got a touch of the grip? 'Cause there's sweat all over your face."
"I might have a touch of something, but mostly I'm fine," I said. "Go on, Percy, tell the warden." He nodded and left, thank Christ for small favors. As soon as the door was closed, I lunged into my office. Leaving the duty desk unmanned was against regulations, but I was beyond caring about that. It was bad, like it had been that morning. I managed to get into the little toilet cubicle behind the desk and to get my business out of my pants before the urine started to gush, but it was a near thing. I had to put a hand over my mouth to stifle a scream as I began to flow and grabbed blindly for the lip of the washstand with the other. It wasn't like my house where I could fall to my knees and piss a puddle beside the woodpile. If I went to my knees here, the urine would go all over the floor. I managed to keep my feet and not to scream, but it was a close thing on both counts. It felt like my urine had been filled with tiny slivers of broken glass. The smell coming up from the toilet bowl was swampy and unpleasant, and I could see white stuff, pus, I guess, floating on the surface of the water. I took the towel off the rack and wiped my face with it. I was sweating all right. It was pouring off me. I looked into the metal mirror and saw the flushed face of a man running a high fever looking back at me. 103? 104? Better not to know, maybe. I put the towel back on its bar, flushed the toilet, and walked slowly back across my office to the cell block door. I was afraid Bill Dodge or someone else might have come in and seen three prisoners with no attendants, but the place was empty. Wharton still lay unconscious on his bunk, Delacroix had fallen silent, and John Coffey had never made a single noise at all, I suddenly realized, not a peep, which was worrisome. I went down the mile and glanced into Coffey's cell, half expecting to discover he'd committed suicide in one of the two common death row ways, either hanging himself with his pants or gnawing into his wrists. No such thing, it turned out. Coffey merely sat on the end of his bunk with his hands in his lap, the largest man I'd ever seen in my life, looking at me with his strange, wet eyes. "Cap'n," he said. "What's up, big boy? I need to see you. Ain't you looking right at me, John Coffey?" He said nothing to this, only went on studying me with his strange, leaky gaze. I sighed. "In a second, big boy." I looked over at Delacroix, who was standing at the bars of his cell. Mr. Jingles, his pet mouse — Delacroix would tell you he'd trained Mr. Jingles to do tricks, but us folks who worked on the Green Mile were pretty much unanimous in the opinion that Mr. Jingles had trained himself — was jumping restlessly back and forth from one of Del's outstretched hands to the other, like an acrobat doing leaps from platforms high above the center ring. His eyes were huge, his ears laid back against his sleek gray skull. I hadn't any doubt that the mouse was reacting to Delacroix's nerves. As I watched, he ran down Delacroix's pants leg and across the cell to where the brightly colored spool lay against one wall. He pushed the spool back to Delacroix's foot, and then looked up at him eagerly. But the little Cajun took no notice of his friend, at least for the time being.
"What happened, boss?"
Delacroix asked.
"Who been hurt?"
"Everything's Jake," I said. "Our new boy came in like a lion, but now he's passed out like a lamb. All's well that ends well."
"It ain't over yet,"
Delacroix said, looking up the mile toward the cell where Wharton was jugged.
"L'homme mauvais, c'est vrai?"
"Well," I said, "don't let it get you down, Del. Nobody's going to make you play skip rope with him out in the yard." There was a creaking sound from behind me as Coffey got off his bunk. "Boss Edgecombe," he said again. This time he sounded urgent. "I need to talk to you." I turned to him, thinking, all right, no problem. Talking was my business. All the time trying not to shiver because the fever had turned cold, as they sometimes will. Except for my groin, which still felt as if it had been slit open, filled with hot coals, and then sewed back up again. "So talk, John Coffey," I said, trying to keep my voice light and calm. For the first time since he'd come on to E Block, Coffey looked as though he was really here, really among us. The almost ceaseless trickle of tears from the corners of his eyes had ceased, at least for the time being, and I knew he was seeing what he was looking at, Mr. Paul Edgecombe, E Block's bull goose screw, and not some place he wished he could go back to and take back the terrible thing he'd done. "No," he said, "you got to come in here." "Now, you know I can't do that," I said, still trying for the light tone, "at least not right this minute. I'm on my own here for the time being, and you outweigh me by just about a ton and a half. We've had us one hoorah this afternoon, and that's enough. So we'll just have a chat through the bars, if it's all the same to you, and please..." He was holding the bars so tightly that his knuckles were pale and his fingernails were white. His face was long with distress, those strange eyes sharp with some need I could not understand. I remember thinking that maybe I could have understood it if I hadn't been so sick, and knowing that would have given me a way of helping him through the rest of it. When you know what a man needs, you know the man more often than not.
"Please, Boss Edgecombe, you have to come in."
That's the nuttiest thing I ever heard, I thought. And then realized something even nuttier. I was going to do it. I had my keys off my belt, and I was hunting through them for the one that opened John Coffey's cell. He could have picked me up and broken me over his knee like kindling on a day when I was well and feeling fine, and this wasn't that day. All the same, I was going to do it. On my own, and less than half an hour after a graphic demonstration of where stupidity and laxness could get you when you were dealing with condemned murderers, I was going to open this black giant's cell, go in and sit with him. If I was discovered, I might well lose my job, even if he didn't do anything crazy, but I was going to do it just the same. "Stop," I said to myself. "You just stop now, Paul." But I didn't. I used one key on the top lock, another on the bottom lock, and then I slid the door back on its track.
"You know, boss, that maybe not such a good idea,"
Delacroix said, in a voice so nervous and prissy it would probably have made me laugh under other circumstances.
"You mind your business and I'll mind mine," I said without looking around.
My eyes were fixed on John Coffey's, and fixed so hard they might have been nailed there. It was like being hypnotized. My voice sounded to my own ears like something which had come echoing down a long valley. Hell, maybe I was hypnotized. "You just lie down and take you a rest."
"Christ, this place is crazy," Delacroix said in a trembling voice. "Mr. Jingles, I just about wish they'd fry me and be done with it."
I went into Coffey's cell. He stepped away as I stepped forward. When he was backed up against his bunk—it hit him in the calves, that's how tall he was—he sat down on it. He patted the mattress beside him, his eyes never once leaving mine. I sat down there next to him, and he put his arm around my shoulders, as if we were at the movies and I was his girl. "What do you want, John Coffey?" I asked, still looking into his eyes, those sad, serene eyes.
"Just to help," he said.
He sighed, like a man will when he's faced with a job he doesn't much want to do. And then he put his hand down in my crotch, on that shelf of bone a foot or so below the navel.
"Hey!" I cried. "Get your goddamn hand!"
A jolt slammed through me then, a big, painless whack of something. It made me jerk on the cot and bow my back, made me think of old Toot shouting that he was frying, he was a done-tom turkey. There was no heat, no feeling of electricity. But for a moment the color seemed to jump out of everything, as if the world had been somehow squeezed and made to sweat. I could see every pore on John Coffey's face. I could see every bloodshot snap in his haunted eyes. I could see a tiny healing scrape on his chin. I was aware that my fingers were hooked down into claws on thin air, and that my feet were drumming on the floor of Coffey's cell. Then it was over. So was my urinary infection. Both the heat and the miserable throbbing pain were gone from my crotch, and the fever was likewise gone from my head. I could still feel the sweat it had drawn out of my skin, and I could smell it. But it was gone, all right.
"What's going on?"
Delacroix called shrilly. His voice still came from far away, but when John Coffey bent forward, breaking eye contact with me, the little Cajun's voice suddenly came clear. It was as if someone had pulled wads of cotton or a pair of shooter's plugs out of my ears.
"What's he doing to you?"
I didn't answer. Coffey was bent forward over his own lap with his face working and his throat bulging. His eyes were bulging, too. He looked like a man with a chicken bone caught in his throat.
"John," I said.
I clapped him on the back. It was all I could think of to do.
"John, what's wrong?"
He hitched under my hand, then made an unpleasant, gagging, retching sound. His mouth opened, the way horses sometimes open their mouths to allow the bit, reluctantly, with the lips peeling back from the teeth in a kind of desperate sneer. Then his teeth parted too, and he exhaled a cloud of tiny black insects that looked like gnats or no-see-ums. At least that was what I thought
Then they swirled furiously between his knees, turned white, and disappeared. Suddenly all the strength went out of my midsection. It was as if the muscles there had turned to water. I slumped back against the stone side of Coffey's cell. I remember thinking the name of the Savior, Christ, 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 over and over like that. And I remember thinking that the fever had driven me delirious. That was all. Then I became aware that Delacroix was bawling for help. He was telling the world that John Coffey was killing me and telling it at the top of his lungs. Coffey was bending over me, all right, but only to make sure I was okay. "Shut up, Del," I said, and stood up. I waited for the pain to rip into my guts, but it didn't happen. I was better. Really. There was a moment of dizziness, but that passed even before I was able to reach out and grab the bars of Coffey's cell door for balance. "I'm totally okey-doke."
"You get on out of there,"
Delacroix said, sounding like a nervy old woman telling a kid to climb down out of that air apple tree.
"You ain't supposed to be in there with no one else on the block."
I looked at John Coffey, who sat on the bunk with his huge hands on the tree stumps of his knees. John Coffey looked back at me. He had to tilt his head up a little, but not much. "What did you do, big boy?" I asked in a low voice. "What did you do to me?"
"Helped," he said. "I helped it, didn't I?"
"Yeah, I guess, but how? How did you help it?" He shook his head, right, left, back to dead center. He didn't know how he'd helped it, how he'd cured it, and his placid face suggested that he didn't give a rat's ass. Any more than I'd give a rat's ass about the mechanics of running when I was leading in the last 50 yards of a 4th of July 2-miler. I thought about asking him how he'd known I was sick in the first place, except that would undoubtedly have gotten the same headshake. There's a phrase I read somewhere and never forgot, something about an enigma wrapped in a mystery. That's what John Coffey was. And I suppose the only reason he could sleep at night was because he didn't care. Percy called him the idiot, which was cruel but not too far off the mark. Our big boy knew his name and knew it wasn't spelled like the drink, and that was just about all he cared to know. As if to emphasize this for me, he shook his head in that deliberate way one more time, then lay down on his bunk with his hands clasped under his left cheek like a pillow and his face to the wall. His legs dangled off the end of the bunk from the shins on down, but that never seemed to bother him. The back of his shirt had pulled up, and I could see the scars that crisscrossed his skin. I left the cell, turned the locks, then faced Delacroix, who was standing across the way with his hands wrapped around the bars of his cell, looking at me anxiously, perhaps even fearfully. Mr. Jingles perched on his shoulder, with his fine whiskers quivering like filaments.
"What that document do to you?"
Delacroix asked.
"What did Grigri? He saw some Grigri on you,"
spoken in that Cajun accent of his, Grigri rhymed with pee-pee. "I don't know what you're talking about, Del."
"Devil you don't! Look at you all change! Even walk different, boss!"
I probably was walking different at that. There was a beautiful feeling of calm in my groin, a sense of peace so remarkable it was almost ecstasy. Anyone who suffered bad pain and then recovered will know what I'm talking about. "Everything's all right, Del," I insisted. "John Coffey had a nightmare, that's all."
"He's a Grigri man,"
Delacroix said vehemently. There was a nestle of sweat beads on his upper lip. He hadn't seen much, just enough to scare him half to death.
"He a hoodoo man."
"What makes you say that?" Delacroix reached up and took the mouse in one hand. He cupped it in his palm and lifted it to his face. From his pocket, Delacroix took out a pink fragment, one of those peppermint candies. He held it out,
But at first the mouse ignored it, stretching out its neck toward the man instead, sniffing at his breath the way a person might sniff at a bouquet of flowers. Its little oil-drop eyes slitted most of the way closed in an expression that looked like ecstasy. Delacroix kissed its nose, and the mouse allowed its nose to be kissed. Then it took the offered piece of candy and began to munch it. Delacroix looked at it a moment longer, then looked at me. All at once I got it. "The mouse told you," I said. "Am I right?"
"Oui."
"Like he whispered his name to you?"
"Oui, in my ear he whispered."
"Lie down, Del," I said. "Have you a little rest. All that whispering back and forth must wear you out." He said something else. Accused me of not believing him, I suppose. His voice seemed to be coming from a long way off again. And when I went back up to the duty desk, I hardly seemed to be walking at all. It was more like I was floating, or maybe not even moving, the cells just rolling past me on either side, movie props on hidden wheels. I started to sit like normal, but halfway into it my knees unlocked, and I dropped onto the blue cushion Harry had brought from home the year before and plopped onto the seat of the chair. If the chair hadn't been there, I reckon I would have plopped straight to the floor without passing go or collecting $200. I sat there, feeling the nothing in my groin where a forest fire had been blazing not 10 minutes before. "I helped it, didn't I?" John Coffey had said, and that was true, as far as my body went. My peace of mind was a different story, though. That he hadn't helped at all. My eyes fell on the stack of forms under the tin ashtray we kept on the corner of the desk. "Block report" was printed at the top, and about halfway down was a blank space headed, "Report all unusual occurrences." I would use that space in tonight's report, telling the story of William Wharton's colorful and action-packed arrival. But suppose I also told what had happened to me in John Coffey's cell. I saw myself picking up the pencil, the one whose tip Brutal was always licking, and writing a single word in big capital letters. Miracle. That should have been funny. But instead of smiling, all at once I felt sure that I was going to cry. I put my hands to my face, palms against my mouth, to stifle the sobs. I didn't want to scare Del again, just when he was starting to get settled down. But no sobs came. No tears, either. After a few moments, I lowered my hands back to the desk and folded them. I didn't know what I was feeling. And the only clear thought in my head was a wish that no one should come back onto the block until I was a little more in control of myself. I was afraid of what they might see in my face. I drew a block report form toward me. I would wait until I had settled down a bit more to write about how my latest problem child had almost strangled Dean Stanton, but I could fill out the rest of the boilerplate foolishness in the meantime. I thought my handwriting might look funny, trembly, but it came out about the same as always. About 5 minutes after I started, I put the pencil down and went into the WC adjacent to my office to take a leak. I didn't need to go very bad, but I could manage enough to test what had happened to me, I thought. As I stood there, waiting for my water to flow, I became sure that it would hurt just the way it had that morning, as if I were passing tiny shards of broken glass. What he'd done to me would turn out to be only hypnosis, after all. And that might be a relief, in spite of the pain. Except there was no pain. And what went into the bowl was clear, with no sign of pus. I buttoned my fly, pulled the chain that flushed the commode, went back to the duty desk, and sat down again. I knew what had happened. I suppose I knew even when I was trying to tell myself I'd been hypnotized. I'd experienced a healing, an authentic, praise Jesus, the Lord is mighty. As a boy who'd grown up going to whatever Baptist or Pentecostal church my mother and her sisters happened to be in favor of during any given month, I had heard plenty of praise Jesus, the Lord is mighty miracle stories. I didn't believe all of them, but there were plenty of people I did believe. One of these was a man named Roy Delphines, who lived with his family about 2 miles down the road from us when I was 6 or so. Delphines had chopped his son's little finger off with a hatchet, an accident which had occurred when the boy unexpectedly moved his hand on a log he'd been holding on the backyard chopping block for his dad. Roy Delphines said he had practically worn out the carpet with his knees that fall and winter, and in the spring the boy's finger had grown back. Even the nail had grown back. I believed Roy Delphines when he testified at Thursday night rejoicing. There was a naked, uncomplicated honesty in what he said, as he stood there talking with his hands jammed deep into the pockets of his bibs, that was impossible not to believe.